What's up, everybody? This is Carrick with ACG, and once again, we are doing a discussion about episodic video games versus episodic TV shows and what they can learn from each other, and we're doing that in the guise of walking through different Stranger Things episodes. This is for Season 2, Episode 2. If you haven't got a chance and you're just jumping into this, check out Episode 1. What I'm going to be doing, and really a good counterpoint to all of this kind of stuff, is just the continual discussion about how games are telling stories, how TV shows tell stories, and the fact that there's actually a good number of examples in both games and TV shows where I think they could cross over and we could see some of those strengths, whether it be in episodic titles or whether it be in normal ones. As always, if you get a chance, I would love for you to spread the word on this. It would help a lot if maybe you tweeted out that you're listening to this, or maybe send somebody the link to Anchor or iTunes, and I would love for you to subscribe. Most likely you're hearing this on Anchor or iTunes, so you already are, but I would love for you to spread the word. It really does help the channel, especially with YouTube doing the weird stuff they do. I uploaded a video today there. If you get a chance, check out that. But these are just going to be in audio form, these ones where we discuss games and sort of how they're put together. I think this is a really good place for us to actually discuss these things. So let's jump right on into it. Once again, Stranger Things, Season 3, Episode 2. So Season 1 covered the sort of the loss of innocence that I think I've talked about with Stranger Things. I think that's one of the high points of Stranger Things, especially with that first season coming out. And a lot of mimicry of different movies thematically. And then you had Season 2, which I think felt a little bit stronger. The characters came together a little bit more. But at the same time, at least for me, Season 2 was missing a little bit. I still liked it a lot, but it was missing a little bit thematically. There's a little bit less, I wouldn't say risk. Yeah, I would say risk. Maybe a little bit less risk for the characters, a little bit less danger. We jump into Season 3, and we go into Episode 1 that we've already discussed, and there's a lot of different movie, thematically, I think, movie copies that they've done for Stranger Things. This is something that we know the Duffer Brothers are fans of, is those older movies. And I would say with this entire season, you're looking at The Blob and Invasion of the Body Snatchers. In Season 1, or Episode 1, we had a couple different areas where that was reflected, not too many. In Episode 2, we do see this more often, especially with the Invasion of the Body Snatchers element and that angle of the story, which I'll talk about. When you sort of twist this over and start looking at games, I think one of the things that we see a lot of times is that games many times just crib from the leading titles. They don't crib from the entire genre. So you see a title that maybe looks at Dark Souls. Dark Souls is always a good example. And I hear this all the time. People will be like, man, I wish people wouldn't say the Dark Souls of shooters or the blah, 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 blah. Well, that's a comparison. And for comparison's sake, to get your point across, you're actually looking for the comparison with the highest percentage of through rate. What that means is the highest percentage of someone understanding without having to go look it up. So Dark Souls is a great example. However, when it comes to developers, we don't want that. So there's one thing to talk about it. There's another thing to create it. And when you get these developers in there, a lot of times you'll see them maybe crib from, let's say, a Dark Souls and maybe the other game that came out recently in one of those areas. Maybe they're looking at The Surge and they think, okay, we're going to make a game like this, but we're going to adjust this, this, and this. And one of the problems with that is that a lot of times we don't really see a fleshed out game. It ends up feeling like a game that just took a couple of the elements. This is something that we've talked about many times, a couple of the mechanics, the mechanisms that worked within those titles, and they try to match them together. And we get a lot of copies. We get a lot of titles that people use the comparison Dark Souls, but that comparison is used in a fairly derogatory way and not in a way of calling to the strengths of, let's say, Dark Souls, because Dark Souls is its own thing. Bloodborne is its own thing. The Surge is its own thing. Ashen is its own thing. However, a couple of those in particular are their own thing, but they're not really as elevated as they should be or as excellent as they should be because maybe they cribbed a little too closely to other titles. What we see and what I would like to see more often with games is for games to take more movie, TV show references and sort of put them on the side. A lot of times when we see a horror movie, you look at like Resident Evil, Japanese-based, the original Resident Evil, and then you jump into, say, Resident Evil 7. Resident Evil 7 is one of my favorite Resident Evils, but when you look at it, it certainly is a westernized Resident Evil. I don't think anybody would argue that. In fact, rumor was, when it was first being developed, it was not a Resident Evil game. And then they looked at it and were like, we can fit Resident Evil into this world. They actually liked where it was going. So they put it all together, and you have sort of a western style to it. what I would like to see more games do is sort of take all of those different elements from different genres and put them together and mix them thematically. For example, when you go back to Stranger Things and you look at Stranger Things, in particular season 3, you do get a blob and you get an Invasion of the Body Snatchers angle. I would like to see that with games where it's not just, oh, this is futuristic Dark Souls, but why don't you go, this is just me talking, not me saying somebody should make a game of this. But what about a futuristic Dark Souls that is also a Metroidvania style game, right? And we've got a couple of those Metroidvania style games that are like one hit, one kill. So we're already seeing people do that. And I would just like to see more and more do it. In fact, there was a game that came out recently. I forget the name, that was sort of a ranged kind of shooter that was Dark Souls. So when you see this, when you're watching Stranger Things, which I think is a good starting point for the discussion, the entire show in season 3, episode 2, starts out right at the very beginning with Billy. So Billy had been captured by whatever this creature was in the steelworks, and he had been pulled down into the basement. And it cuts to the start, and at the very start, Billy escapes. Now, something that a lot of people didn't notice, and certainly many people questioned, was he gets up and he runs to his car, and he's able to start it instantly. But he was not able to start it when he crashed it at the end of the other episode. That's because it was flooded, and that's a really good tell for how long it occurred, how long between the two episodes actually had been. Now, this is something that if you don't have a carbureted vehicle or have not ever worked on a carbureted vehicle, you may not even know what flooded means. A lot of fuel-injected vehicles, the way they work, not a lot, all, it's not going to have the exact same issue that a carbureted one will, or it will, but in a different way. But truly flooded, especially with carbureted engines, and which is what Billy was driving, it simply means the liquid gasoline floods it. There's too much liquid gasoline, and you actually need it to be in a vapor to actually burn correctly. So that gets flooded, and it takes a particular amount of time for that fuel to turn into and evaporate into a gas, and for you to get that out of the system so you can start it back up so the spark plugs can actually spark. Because a lot of people don't realize that actually fluid gas, the liquid of gas, is very difficult to light on fire. You can drop a match in it many times, as long as there's not a bunch of vapor on top of the liquid. So I like this. I thought it was a really well done time passing kind of moment. It's like just this hint of time passing, and you wouldn't even pick up on it unless you knew that technology. But it was also a good hint as to that the developers, or that the directors, were taking care to watch these kind of things. And I would like to see games do that too, where sometimes things just don't make sense. We talk about it in games where you see a game and a guy like drops a weapon next to another weapon, but then picks up the shit one. And you're like, well, there's a gun right there and there's a bat. He drops the bat and he grabbed the bat again. It's like, why didn't he grab the gun? You know, those things that don't logically make sense. So it jumps into Billy. Like I said, he drives off and he goes to a telephone booth and he makes a phone call to 911. When he makes a phone call to 911, he has a vision, and this is a very short vision, but you get some really creepy snippets. You get snippets of him being attacked by something, something basically stuck to his face, like the alien facehugger kind of thing, and him escaping. And it cuts, and he's suddenly in the upside down. He walks outside, or out of the telephone booth, and he sees a group of people coming towards him, and he can't tell who they are. It's all shaded, it's all foggy, and he's not able to see who they are until his doppelganger walks out of the group and comes up to him looking just like him, which is a very Invasion of the Body Snatchers moment. We see it in a lot of TV shows, a lot of movies that are trying to do an Invasion of the Body Snatchers moment where the protagonist or another character who's about to meet their doom sees themselves because the body snatchers have copied them. And I liked that element here. I think it sort of solidified something absolutely creepy and in a way different was going on in this episode that did not technically occur in the prior ones. This is something I talked about in season 3, episode 1 in the last video, or the last podcast, where I talked about how it sort of changed things up every season, and that's a change, I think, that goes on here that I really do like. The next cut we get is actually one of my favorite parts of the show, because I think it shows a big sort of plot twisting point for this entire season. It starts with you got Eleven outside of her house looking for Mikey. He hasn't showed up after his meeting with Hopper the next day. She goes in, she makes a phone call, and her and Mikey talk, and she accuses him of lying because Mikey comes up with all of these different excuses about, like, his grandma being sick, even though his own mother is on the phone eavesdropping and is like, what? I didn't know she was sick. And She hangs up, and Mikey still somehow in some way causes Eleven to believe that something is going on that's not necessarily him not wanting to see her. And so they hang up the phone. And what I thought was very cool here is you see this momentary smile on Hopper's face. Again, this really does show the drive that Hopper has. He needs to take care of her. And the feeling that the chaos of Mikey being slightly stymied is really, really, there's a lot of satisfaction for him in this. There's a lot of satisfaction for Hopper in feeling this way. There's so much so that he jumps in his truck and it cuts to him singing. He's so elated at finally seeing this momentary break in the chaos that he, and in the oddity that he really can't control. You can't control teenagers. You hear this from parents all the time. And Hopper is not a great parent. He hasn't had the skills to be a great parent. He tries. Caring is in some way connected to trying, but not all the time, because we have people who care who don't try, and people who try that really it's just an activity and they're not really caring. I like that. It worked really well to solidify Hopper as a guy who, you could go too far and be like, oh, Hopper's just mean or he's controlling. You could say that. But I actually, when you look at it from sort of a 1,000 feet up and you sort of separate yourself and you don't get too emotional about it and you look at it, it's a very cool growth point even for Hopper, because he'll have this celebration now, but later in the episodes, there's, I wouldn't say a lack of celebration, but there's the fact that Hopper may have made a bad decision at this point that ends up paying off and sort of showing you the growth, his excitement. And we've all had that moment. I'm sure we have. I'm sure I'm talking to everybody here where we've all had that amazing moment that is stymied by that bad thought. You have that amazing moment and then you're like, uh-oh. For this one, for Hopper, it takes a longer a period of time, but it still does happen. So he's singing. He's just having such a great time, and it's cool to see him this happy. He drives in to tell Joyce. He's incredibly happy with himself. He asks Joyce out when they're talking. Joyce is really celebrating with him. She's happy that he's done so well. He gives her the kudos for it. He says, you know, you helped me, even though in a way that's deferring the guilt that he'll feel later. But he's like, you helped me with this discussion. And he asks her out. And he indicates it's not a date, but he does show some importance in the invite. So it's an uncomfortable moment where two characters are not necessarily communicating and his emotional state is sort of all over the place. And it works really well to show once again their lack of communication. As he's celebrating, he gets a telephone call from his deputy that says he needs to go to City Hall. So he decides he's going to go. And he ends up walking past some magnets that have demagnetized from an area in Joyce's shop. This is something I talked about in the prior episode. So we sort of get this secondary thing where something scientific is going on or supernatural, right? We don't know. But you see these demagnetized. So Hopper decides he's going to jump in his truck and he's going to drive off. They sort of solidify the date time and he does. He ends up going off to sort of stop these picketers who are picketing the mall. This is second or third time where the mall is really indicated as not only a positive place for, let's say, the children, but there's a shadowy thing going on with the mall. Or at the very least, it's set up not as an antagonist, but as sort of a maybe even just a neutral kind of situation, but a situation that has different impact on different people. When it comes to games, this is something that's actually not done very well. We don't actually see it very often, and the easiest way to see it in some games, I would say, is if you have, let's say, a base, and you have a base that's got its positives and negatives. Let's say you have a game where you can set up a base in multiple places. Even an RTS in some way would reflect this, but strangely enough, a game that reflects this quite well, that is a place where people have different experiences due to sort of how it impacts them, is State of Decay 2. Where in State of Decay 1 in particular, both of those, but you have this world where you have these different bases you set up, they have the positive negatives, and you can sort of see the differences they will have on different people depending on the gameplay style. And in a way, even though this is a story part in Stranger Things, I think in gameplay, that's usually where you see it reflected is in the gameplay. You rarely see these really reflected in the story that much. You don't really see this dual storytelling in stories because most of the time I think it's just too hard for a game developer to figure out how to do that. We also know that many times cutscenes are the last thing to be created. This is quite well known when you look at many games where cutscenes are messed up. Days Gone is a good example of that, where we know that cuts cause their cutscenes to be adjusted pretty much right up until it went gold. We have this come up in other games. Just Cause 4 had some issues with its cutscenes until they patched them later to fix them. Cutscenes are notorious for being right at the end. In fact, many times if you have a PC game, you can go into their folders and they'll have cutscenes that aren't even in the game because they've been removed, but nobody removed them from the file folder. So this is something that we definitely do see. I would like to see it more in games, though. I like that duality of storytelling where something is there and it's not necessarily hyper impactful on the gameplay, but it's sort of another thing occurring, that duality of story and purpose I really do like. So Hopper gets that call, and it cuts to Nancy. Nancy is now back at work. She ends up asking Tom. Now, he's the newspaper editor, and again, we don't necessarily know. We think we know what he's like. Overall, we certainly do think we know what he's like. However, at the same time, there is still sort of a question exactly, you know, where he stands on Nancy. You know, is he, like, following the rest of the guys? Is he... Does he have a certain thought process towards, like, women in the workplace? We're not 100% sure. Nancy comes in. She asks Tom if she could go to the doctor. And I think this is a good moment when Nancy lies. And she says, oh, it's because of my lady parts. I'm having, you know, a problem with my lady parts or something like that. I think she says she's having woman issues. And Tom spits out his coffee. He's very uncomfortable by that. And immediately lets her go. He's like, man, go. Nancy was lying. And I think we get an idea of what of overall what Tom is like at that point. Nancy's lying and she goes to investigate the rats and the call she got from the lady who reported something was going on with rats. She ends up dragging Jonathan along at the same time. And this is something that we see throughout the game is the one character that always wants to pull back, or during the show, the one character that always wants to pull back and doesn't really want to break their status quo. We see this in video games a lot of times where you get one character. What I like about Stranger Things and what I'd like to see in video games is a more complex narrative where you can have more than one. Because in this group in Stranger Things, you have at least two or three characters who sort of drag, right? And I'm not talking about them not communicating. That's a true complaint I have. But I'm talking about where they want to keep that status quo the way it is. You know, at the very least, Will is like that. And you would say in many ways, Hopper's like that. And now here again, you would say in many ways, Jonathan is like that. And I love that. I like that tiered, that triple off. It's sort of an unbalanced thing. You have three people all in a different group, technically, and all of them wanting to sort of hold everything at its core in the way it is, not because they're bad people. And I would like to see that more in games. We don't see that in games. Games rarely do more than one. Maybe they'll do two, but usually they're too drawn out. There's a very cumbersome feeling in most games where the bad guy has to be an incredibly bad guy, or they have to be a good guy who then turns out to be a bad guy, but they were so candy, sweet, nice that you're like, yeah, whatever, this guy's for sure a bad guy, right? You don't really question it. What I would like to see is far more nuance in the storytelling in games when it comes to stuff like this. And these are a lot of things that anybody who develops a game could look at when it comes to Stranger Things. And it doesn't have to be episodic where these improvements could be made, that's for sure. So as Jonathan and Nancy drive off, it cuts to a scene of the mall. This is very 1980s. And to Steve and Robin in the ice cream shop, and Dustin shows up, and this is the first time where we really get Steve and Dustin meeting up again, and we get that friendship that occurred from the second season. And this is done in a multitude of ways that I think is very layered and really well done. First, we've already seen Steve is off his game, and we don't quite know why, right? We think it's school. We think it's Billy has shown up and he's sort of become the popular kid. Steve has definitely had issues. He got his ass kicked in the second season. And we know that that can sometimes affect your popularity at school. But when Dustin shows up, I think almost everybody gets the point that they understand exactly why Steve is having issues fitting in. Because he doesn't. He's trying to foot the bill between two different worlds. One, the nerds, and the other, the popular jocks and the preps and all of those type of people. Dustin shows up and they have this Star Wars battle nerd celebration. And as they have the nerd celebration, they actually have this really cool music cue that pops up. And then you get Robin like going and looking at them and making a one-liner about them. But it's condescending, but it's never that kind of really harsh condescending that she does. It's more just taking Steve down a little bit of a notch. And one of the cool things about Robin is I would say she's a lot like characters you get in a game who, when somebody comes up with a decision, they're like, dude, that's the dumbest goddamn decision I've ever heard of. What are you talking about? That's Robin in a way, where Steve and Dustin are celebrating and Robin's comment slows them down just for a second, or slows Steve down. And it's a reminder of Steve of sort of what he is, which I definitely liked. I thought that was great. So it cuts off to the side. Dustin's explaining the girlfriend to Steve, and you can't tell if Steve really believes Dustin or not. Dustin tells him about how pretty she is and all this stuff, and the fact that Dustin's girlfriend, because he has this disease where his teeth, or he calls them his pearls, haven't grown in yet, his girlfriend likes kissing without the teeth, which is just, you see Steve's, the look on his face is just priceless. And he's like, okay, yeah, that's sort of romantic. He says something along that line. So it's a very good moment between these guys. Steve had a moment there to be very atypical in his response. And his response could have been that atypical, sarcastic response. And it wasn't. It was in support of Dustin, which I think once again shows that growth in that character. And that's something, again, we don't see very often in games, because either they don't have enough time to celebrate those changes. But we see long games, 40, 50, 60 hours, that still don't do this. I would argue, I think a lot of us would argue that Witcher 3 probably does a fairly okay job with this. I personally don't think it does near as good of a job as everybody else does with its story. But it certainly has the chops. But we see most games at this length. A Skyrim, for example, there's almost no real storytelling there, and certainly no nuance. And this layer of nuance, really, once again, not that difficult to do, especially if you've got a longer game. And I would love to see more companies do this kind of thing, where you have that momentary thought process of like, did he just do that because of this? So they're all talking together, and Dustin tells Steve about his friends leaving. This is a cool bonding point, because it starts there. Dustin did not need to tell him about this at all, but he tells him. And this is another point where Dustin and Steve are making their own click. And this is something that's continued through this season, I think, where Dustin and Steve, and in most of the parts, Robin, create their own clique, because they agree on this thing. They're all outsiders. And you find out that Robin's pretty much an outsider as well. So it's this very cool moment where they come together and they sort of decide this, I would say subconsciously. Like, you never see them admit it, but you can sort of tell that that's where this is going. Dustin tells him about the Russian signal at this point, and they have this great moment where Steve's teasing Dustin for not saying what he found, which was the Russian signal. He makes him repeat it 3 times until Dustin screams, and then Steve's like, yeah, that's what I thought you said. You know, it's just these really cool one-liners between the two, but it solidifies that friendship, but at the same time, it moves the story forward. You don't have to have the friendship moment by itself. And we'll see that in a lot of games too. There's a lot of good examples. And in fact, I would say some of the premier games that a lot of us like still have examples of this, where a game doesn't have the nuance to do the two things at once, to deliver the joke and the nuanced story moment at the same time, or the nuanced story moment and the actual furthering of the plot. Instead, it's more like 1, 2, 3. It's almost like they don't know when you're going to see some of these cutscenes, so they're a little nervous about that. And that's a valid point on video games. We don't know some games, if they're open world, when you're going to get that cutscene. I've talked about this in games before, where you get that jackass quest where somebody's like, yeah, no, I just met you, man, but can you go save my child? They're dying from a virus. And you're all, okay. And then you come back after 1,000 hours of collecting mushrooms in the hills, and they're still waiting for you. And that lack of nuance, and that certainly, I would say, doesn't occur here. So they all sort of discuss the Russian signal for a little bit. He talks to Steve, and it moves on from there. And it goes to 11 meeting up with Max. Now, Max is outside of her house. She's practicing the skateboard. She's trying to get better. Max is also another character that is only in the group really because of Lucas. I would say she doesn't have a ton to offer to that group when it comes to narrative slant, or even to the group friendship slant. But because she is friends or boyfriend and girlfriend with Lucas, it's a little easier for her to mix in. And 11 and her sort of start to discuss 11's issues with Mikey. And this is where I would say it starts to go a little wayward with this character in particular. I talked about this in the episode 1 with Max. Max comes across as nothing really more than a reason to get 11 to act a certain way, if that makes sense. She doesn't really add anything skill-wise to the show at all, which is strange because everybody else, maybe less so actually Lucas in this season, but usually everybody adds something to the show, adds something to the skill set of the show, whether that be almost like the idea-generating factory that Dustin is in his brain. Whether it's right or wrong, he saves the day multiple times. Nancy Drew, or Nancy as we call her. You know, she's just Nancy. She does an incredible job that people call her Nancy Drew in this season. So you get those kind of moments, but you don't get that from Max. And Max really starts to sort of let out her aggressiveness towards 11, and it doesn't make a lot of sense because, for example, she's dating Lucas, who's one of the nicest characters on the show. There's literally no reason for her to just be that angry at guys, and she ends up putting a chip pretty quickly on 11's shoulder, and just even her verbiage is really odd when it comes to this. Again, like I said, this is definitely a character that I don't feel has really done a good job on being portrayed well. Again, no issues with the actress. I think she does fine. I just think what she's working with seems very odd. It's like they don't know what to do. So it jumps from them and it goes to Mikey, Will, and Lucas discussing the same issues at their D&D game. This is really a poignant moment, I think, if you understand what's going on. They don't cut to it or fade in or do anything to make you feel like it's a poignant moment, and they certainly don't focus on it. But I think it is if you understand the sense of change that's occurring. And what you have is Will. He's doing everything he can to keep the group doing the same stuff. And what's cool about Will is he's sort of stuck. He is sort of stuck by the emotional shit that happened in season one and in season two, both. He's got this issue and it's continued to crop up. It can't be fixed or doesn't seem to be fixed. And he's stuck and he doesn't know what to do. So he wants to keep everything the same. And you get a really cool moment of this where he's building the D&D world on his map. And you see he's very, very structured with everything he's building. He's very careful with every item. While at the same time, it cuts quite quickly to Lucas talking to Mikey. And Mikey is explaining to him what Hopper said. And there's this discussion back and forth where Lucas basically tells him, you know, you're in deep shit. I was dumped 5 times by Max through the summer, and I've got her back each and every time. And he's sort of trying to talk him back into, or at least talk him into understanding that it isn't as big of a deal as maybe Mikey thinks it is. And it doesn't take very long in this section before it cuts away. And it cuts to the swimming pool. This is Billy showing up. This time he's acting slightly weird. This is reflected, we see a lot of times in video games, horror games in particular, where you get that character who like shows up in the major group, but they're acting off because outside of the major storyline, something bad's happened. That's what we get here. However, one of the really good moments actually happens here as well. A lot of good moments happen in episode two. The mother, Mrs. Wheeler, comes in and she apologizes to Billy about not showing up, basically not showing up to have sex. And it cuts and Billy's sweating. He's, you know, he looks terrible. Everything just appears to be bothering him. He looks very uncomfortable and he envisions killing her. He envisions turning around and grabbing her. And this is the one moment where I'm going to say this. Billy, I personally believe in this moment, was trying to be a good person. He has this vision. He turns to Mrs. Wheeler and he says, "Stay away from me." And he doesn't just say that. I think he says, "Don't ever come near me," or something like that. And you get this moment where you sort of pick up on the fact that he knows that despite all of the issues he's got, and he's got a plethora of problems, that whatever is going on is dangerous, far more dangerous than, you know, his sweaty ass can be. So he actually tells her to leave. And it's difficult to know if that's any actual compassion towards a person, towards any person, or what exactly. But it's a very cool moment when he says that after he has that vision of killing her. And he does it in a Billy way. He doesn't say, "I need you to stay away." He's like, "Just stay the fuck away," that kind of thing. As he leaves, he continues to show signs of something infecting, and bright lights are starting to bother him, which I think is a good indicator of something from, you know, the upside down actually infecting him. So you actually get those moments. And he goes to his job as a lifeguard. You can tell he's confused about what's going on the entire time. He's stumbling around. He actually looks drunk. You see a couple people looking at him odd, but he ends up going over and taken over. So then it cuts and it shows Lucas's little sister, Erica. So she's going to be somewhat of a major part in this show. She's sitting there bothering Robin at the ice cream shop, asking Robin to sample every single ice cream in the ice cream shop. I think a lot of people like this character. I would say that I personally felt that they were really, really cliched. I'll get to that in a bit. It certainly didn't really, I guess, open up as wide as I was hoping it was going to do with his little sister. But it is a pretty cool entry. You get an idea of just the way she is. She obviously is working the game kind of thing. She's asking for every single sample, and they're these little tiny baby scoops. And she's like, okay, can I get vanilla? She gets that. And she's like, I don't remember the flavors. But then she's like, can I get strawberry? Then she's like, can I get, you know, and she just keeps doing that and that doesn't have to pay. What's interesting here is, and I don't know if they did this on purpose, but she's actually with friends, and you never see the friends ever interact with anybody or talk, which, other than maybe between themselves. I thought that was a little odd that they were there, especially so many times, but we do definitely see that. So Robin has sort of, not a freak out, but she's disturbed by this or frustrated by Lucas's little sister. So she goes in back, and the entire time she's been in front, Steve and Dustin aren't very good at being quiet. So she comes back and she indicates to them that she already knows what the issue is. She already knows there's a Russian broadcast. She already knows that they're having trouble translating it because Steve and Dustin have decided to go in the back and they're trying to figure this out. What I really loved about this moment, though, was she ends up fooling them for a second, but then tells them she was fooling them. But she says, I know this language, this language, this language. And she speaks in pig Latin. And to indicate just how clueless Steve and Dustin are in this segment, and once again, shows a skill that I think Robin brings to the table, but we don't see perhaps Max or others bring to the table. She ends up speaking pig Latin and completely fools Steve and Dustin. And they're like, whoa. And she's like, dude, you idiots, that's pig Latin. But she's like, I understand how to translate languages and I have good ears. And so she sort of introduces her skill right away. This is something we see in a lot of games where a character will come in and introduce a skill. We do see useless characters in a lot of games, but I would say Stranger Things, especially in the show, you do have at least two or three in this main group that appear fairly useless. I would say you could argue their usefulness in games. I think that's usually minimized, but that might be more of a resources issue versus anything else. Now, from there, we get a fairly quick cut. It goes to Nancy and Jonathan meeting Mrs. Driscoll. This is the first time she's introduced. Mrs. Driscoll is the one who reported weird rats and called in to the newspaper late at night. This is that call that Nancy probably wasn't supposed to pick up at all, but did, and this sort of starts everything. Admittedly, when you look back at the story, you go, like, if Nancy hadn't been at the newspaper at that exact time and hadn't picked up the phone call at that exact time, no one would probably be alive at the end of this series. But it's just sort of the way storytelling works. And it does introduce, I think, us to Nancy and her excellent level of investigative skill that starts to come up. And certainly her willingness to continue to plug away at a problem, regardless of who's in front of her. And even if many times that's Jonathan, which we'll certainly talk about. So they meet Mrs. Driscoll. She's an older lady. She walks them around the house. Mrs. Driscoll has a great moment here, a very humanizing moment. We see this in some games where you meet that NPC and they got one or two little idiosyncrasies. Mrs. Driscoll walks them in and she says, oh, you can come in, blah, blah, blah. Things, I can't remember if she says, like, things aren't as clean since, like, her husband died. Nancy says, oh, I'm really sorry. And she's like, ah, it's no big deal. I sort of liked it quieter anyway. And I thought that was awesome. And it was, that's it. That's all you get. You don't get a big indicator of her being a jackass or anything. But what that does do, and it does it very intelligently, that one-liner could have been anything, right? He smelled, he this, he that. It could have been about somebody else. Instead, it did two things, and it did two things incredibly intelligently. It indicates an NPC or a person here an actor with some kind of subtle sort of storyline, goofy storyline, a little momentary bit. But it also solidified the fact that she is alone. And I think that that matters, especially as we go forward in the story. Very good use of a single sentence to do two or three things at once, which is something that, again, like I said, I would like games to be a bit more subtle with their storytelling, and I would love to see that. So they end up investigating down in the basement, and this is the first time they find something very odd. Nancy finds that the fertilizer, for whatever reason, has been eaten. Bags of fertilizer have been eaten by rats, and neither her nor Jonathan nor Miss Driscoll have ever heard of that kind of thing happening. And just as they're ready to go, or at least take that next step, a sound comes from another room, and Nancy's like, what's that? And Miss Driscoll is like, oh, that's something else I was going to show you. And she comes and walks them around. You see a bird cage, and in the bird cage, you can't tell what's in there yet. There's a blanket over it, and you see something inside, and she ends up admitting she caught one of the rats. You don't get to see it yet. But I liked this just moment where it sort of shows you that this area, this particular item, and this person might be more important later on for the story. It's a very good I think, focus in on something, and then it just moves away without any real pause. Very well done. So then it cuts to Jim Hopper meeting the mayor for the first time. Now, the mayor's played, his name's Larry, he's played by Cary Elwes, and who does an amazing job as a side actor. He doesn't end up elevating above everybody else, but he does a really good job, and you'll never look at The Princess Bride the same way, probably, once you see him and the way he acts. As Hopper is waiting to meet him, however, you finally get to see this massive dude leaving the courthouse, having just met him. And it dawns on you as you see him walk out, you never see his face. And they do that quite a few times in this, where they sort of indicate he's so big, or maybe to give him a size, a feeling of size, they don't show it. But he leaves with a motorcycle helmet on, and it dawns on you, most likely, that is the Russian spy from the starting of season 3, episode 1. So Hopper goes in, they sit down to talk about the mall, and Cary explains he wants not only, they're talking about the mall, but they're also talking about the picketers. And Cary explains that he wants the picketers gone. And Jim says that he really can't help, he can't help Larry get rid of these people because they're just giving, or just using their God-given right of picketing and their God-given right kind of thing in this small town of displaying not being happy about something. And you get that idea, of course, they're not happy about the mall and what the mall has done. This is one more indicator of the mall being a more central point. It's easy to actually miss this too. I had multiple people who watched this that did not pick up right away, or at least as of yet, that the mall was sort of a deal. And I think that's very cool. There's nothing wrong with them not picking it up, because again, I think it just shows the slight misdirection that these guys have shown in the past seasons. So you never quite know what's going to be important, but it's very well done. And then Larry, at the end of this discussion, Larry says, oh yeah, you know, I get that. But the only way they can pick it is if they have a permit. And do they? And you see Hopper sort of look at him, and you realize, yeah, they don't. And then Hopper leaves, leaving with the idea that he's going to basically wrap these guys up and take them away. During this discussion, they also talk about Larry stating that in 4 days, they're going to have a huge circus slash fair, and all the voters are going to be there. And Larry isn't worried about kicking these picketers off his lawn, because he believes that when he throws this big 4th of July moment, it'll be more than enough to create a focus on that and not on him picketing these people. And this is a very cool thing that you pick up from Larry, is this sense of misdirection. He's not the most smart man in the world, but especially as we go forward in the show, you start to pick up on the fact that if there's anything about him, he is a very good master of misdirection, whether you find out he for sure is from an action, or there's a subtle hint from a character talking to him, but it definitely does work to make you understand exactly what he's like. So as it moves from there, it goes to 11 and Max going to the mall shopping. This is one of those come into your lifestyle moments in a show, especially this kind of show. It's got a lot of 1980s references. But what I found was weird was when they come off of the bus, this is once again one of my problems with Max, not only not offering really any skills to add to the group other than, let's say, her relationship with Billy, who is her brother. But when she gets off the bus, 11 gets a very nervous look on her face, and she says, too many people. And she indicates to Max that her dad, that Hopper, has warned her about the powers and that they're dangerous with too many people. And Max, I guess like a typical child, just breaks right through that and states like something along the lines of, do you always listen to him or what have you? They end up going in anyway. And I found that, once again, pretty odd. 11, yes, she's rebellious, but there's really nothing that Max is offering other than here's this place to go into, obviously an escape from a breakup. And it's hard to generalize and understand what a teenager is going to do. It just comes across as, once again, Max, as I open up a cold one here, as Max, you know, she's talking and she's just not a very good person. She's throwing caution to the wind. She seems to be almost only interested in 11 due to her powers. Like, that's pretty much the only reason she seems to be friends with her. And we see that later as well, for sure, in the later episodes, where that character becomes, I would say, almost dangerous to 11. So it's definitely something that I think I'll have to watch this show again, but overall wasn't a big fan of. So they go in and they start sort of their 1980s girl mall moment that we see in a lot of older movies. So from there, it cuts to Joyce, and Joyce is at her store, and she's already put these magnets up, and she now has these math books and magnetism books out in front of her, and she's trying to figure out what's going on with these magnets. She decides out of the blue, I'm going to leave the store and I'm going to drive somewhere. And I thought this was once again telling of exactly how bad the mall has impacted business, because she just leaves the business. Nobody has ever been in there other than Hopper that we've seen. And she just drives off. She's right in the middle of the workday. She's like, okay, I'm out of here. And I thought that was very cool. It just sort of really showed you exactly what that mall has done. And then the mall at that point, now you start to really feel like the mall's a bad guy if you're paying attention to these things. As we sort of get an indication of where Joyce is going, I did like this next time frame in the story, because it does feel like almost like a role-playing game. If you've ever played Dungeons and Dragons, if you've ever played a role-playing game, especially longer ones or more investigative ones where it's not just, you know, killing a bunch of people, a lot of times you'll sort of have that cipher character or a couple characters that have information you need to go and get from. And not just like, hey, help me figure out who murdered somebody, but really a smaller step. So if you really think of, let's say, a story as a ladder, and you think of, you know, you extend it all the way, you have a three-section ladder, you extend it all the way, and each rung is a story element. To me, there are these very cool side characters in many of the greater games that are like those locks that lock the different elevator or the different ladder sections from collapsing on one another. And that's sort of this one character that Joyce goes to go see, because she ends up going to see the math teacher that we have seen in season 1 and 2. And I thought this was great. He's by himself. He's painting like Warhammer or Dungeon and Dragons miniatures or a war game miniature, and he ignores her. He's got like some 1980s, you know, pop music on, and the door to, as she's getting ready to leave, she's knocking on his door, nothing happens. As she's getting ready to leave, the garage door opens up. He's got his white fucking, you know, tennis shoe, tenny runner fucking socks up to his knees, and he realizes who it is, and he's like, you know, Joyce. And she sort of sees him, and they do this acknowledgement, and then you get the idea that he's at least going to hear her out. But I thought this was cool, because like I said, if you do really think of a story as those rungs in a ladder, then you have that occasional character that puts it together. And if you really envision season 1, 2, and 3 as their own full complete story, each section of ladder, but each section of a ladder, and maybe it's a 3-section ladder indicating season 1 is the bottom section, season 2 middle, season 3 the top end, you have to keep those things from sliding back closed, right? And you usually have those latches. And to me, there's something about these side characters, not just the math teacher. I don't want to put too much importance on him by any means, but there's something that grounds everything together. And the fact that this math teacher has tried to help the kids in the other seasons, and here is helping Joyce in this one, and gives them just a small snippet to move to the next section, in a way, is what they're doing. And I think it really does do a good job with that storytelling. This is something that in games you'll see repeated, like, let's say, oh, you're going to go talk to the witch in the woods who has the certain weapon you need or a certain little bit of information. But I found with a lot of games, they don't do a great job really making that feel softer. They do it's the hard thing. It's like, you know exactly what you're going to get. Like, you need to go here. And one of the nice parts of Stranger Things, of course, or a TV show, is that the characters are not controlled by a person. So you don't know where Joyce is going. You don't know what she's even trying to do, because she's not talking out loud. With a lot of games, you do. But there are a lot of these I think could be reflected better in games. And I would like to see these kind of characters that just offer a little bit and then go away, and not always be a mysterious character. We see that in Dragon's Dogma, for instance. There'll be times where you'll see like a character on the side and you'll be like, who's that? Yeah, that's great and everything, and it's added mystery and everything. But sometimes I would just like a little bit more of those characters that just offer you a little brief snippet of something to move you forward. And I don't mean a life lesson or a mechanics lesson, but something for, let's say, the larger quest you may be on, that isn't just like, you need mushrooms. I know where mushrooms are growing. That's not what this character is doing. This character is really, if you use that same example, this character is not only telling you where they might be, but telling you how they grow. And there's more data in that than there is if they point the exact way, if you understand what I'm saying. And I like that about the math teacher. I think it's very cool that he's been in all these seasons. So from there, it cuts to Nancy. Now, Nancy's still in Mrs. Driscoll's home. She's making calls to the police department. You get this forcefulness from Nancy that's so great. She's still nervous when she's on the phone, but she doesn't quit the action. She's asking other places if they've noticed that fertilizer's been eaten, and she's sort of stumbling over words, but it doesn't matter. Because as she's doing that, man, it's like the moment that phone, you know, she gets that answer, she does or doesn't need, she's immediately looking in the phone book to get another one. Even Mrs. Driscoll sort of comments on her. I think that's well done. It also shows Jonathan. Now, he's in the basement, and he's trying to take pictures of what you now see is this rabid rat, or basically what looks like a rabid rat. One of the elements you'll notice is that he's taking a picture with a flash downstairs, which makes sense. That's certainly what you need to do. Even with today's digital cams, if you don't have a really good sensor, you're going to need a lot of brightness. However, he doesn't pick up on the fact that when that flash is going off multiple times, that it's causing this rat to freak out even more every time he takes the picture, which is a good reflection of what Billy is doing when he's afraid of light or doesn't want to look directly at, you know, bright lights. And it's that sort of the upside down has infected these creatures. And that's one of, I guess you would say, one of the weaknesses that they have. So he ends up taking these pictures and Nancy comes and get him and they decide to go. They're going to go do some more investigation. And when they leave, the rat flips on its side and it basically explodes just like the rats in episode one. However, this one goes full blob. This is really where, if you understand your movie references, you'll pick up on it right away. Not only does it turn into full blob, it's got these chitinous pieces in it. It's got like what looks like bone and worms in it. It comes out, it squeezes out of the cage, leaving what I can see is very little residue. It's almost like everything, and we'll understand later on in the show why this is done. Almost everything is contained within it, as in it doesn't leave any part behind. It falls to the ground, and then it turns. It was really a nasty moment. I think it was awesome. It turns into something that sort of mutates on its own to escape, and it was very cool. It didn't stay in blob form. It has that ability to sort of transform quite quickly into something else, and we see that. We see, in fact, even though it's a small amount, it's fairly mobile, and it gives you that feeling you don't quite know that in the future are these small mobile bits going to be dangerous, because it doesn't, I'm not saying it pops a wheelie or anything, but it moves around fast enough that you wouldn't want it in a basement with you for a long period of time, because it'd either tucker you out or, you know, it wouldn't catch up to you, but if you ever fell or something like that, it'd probably get on you pretty quick. So I thought that was cool. I also think thematically, I'm going to move my mic here. This probably doesn't make any sense, as in it's probably not a real thing they did, but I think thematically it was very cool that this creature sort of moves around. All separate pieces can be collected together with this force, right? It can sort of, if there's a piece of it missing, it can sort of suck that piece to it. It can mutate itself and control and create itself. But then you have the magnets being demagnetized, coming undone. And again, thematically, it could have been subconscious and it could have been for no reason at all. That's why we're discussing TV shows and movies, because these things were, you know, no one's 100% sure. But I thought that was cool. And I don't know, you know, I was thinking to myself, if Joyce had been there, would Joyce have used that opposite reaction as a reminder of what she's dealing with which is the magnetism and all the craziness there? Like, because sometimes you'll look at something and somebody can show you an additive discussion point. Like you're talking about something and somebody will add something and you just continue on that one bit. But the way you truly pick up on something is getting sort of the opposite point. This is something that comes up. You'll hear it in discussion, especially in debate classes. You'll hear this a lot of times. If you're debating somebody, you are trying to poke holes in their debate, but what you're also trying to do is understand from every facet possible where their debate is coming from. Because in a way, when you strengthen their debate and understand exactly where their most powerful points are, your argument becomes stronger. The opposite becomes stronger in a way. You sort of understand it from both sides, not only the side where you can add a bunch of evidence on your side, but where you can understand the opposite on their side. And that's what sort of happens here with the blob coming together and then the magnets on the other side. Don't know if it's on purpose, but I thought thematically it was cool. So then it cuts to Billy having the vision again, and the vision is about the doppelgangers and the Upside Down, and his doppelganger comes up to him and says, build what you see. And Billy's screams of terror are pretty cool. He's just screaming. He's like, I don't understand what you mean. I don't understand what's going on. I don't understand even really what you're saying. And then it cuts, and Billy is back on the lifeguard stand, not looking good at all. Billy looks fucked. He looks messed up. He doesn't look healthy. He's all sweaty. The sun's bothering him. And he sees he's got a scar on his arm of some kind. And this is a scar that you don't really pick up on in the other scenes with him. It's just sort of a new dilemma that he's got. So he gets down out of the lifeguard station. He goes and he ends up in the swimming pool showers, and he touches it and he's in pain. And he ends up having a vision, or he sees the female lifeguard come up to him, and she comes up to him and says, take me to him. And he's like, what? And then it cuts back and you realize he had a vision when she said that. And instead it's just her saying, are you okay? Do you need to go to the hospital? And before there's even really a moment of thought, he ends up grabbing her and pulling her into the shower and covering the shower stall. So it's obvious that he's going to kidnap her and do exactly what she says in his dream. Overall, I think it'd be easy to sort of question the number of cuts that they have in this. And certainly if you saw it in a video game, you'd think it was like an MTV movie all of a sudden, something filmed by MTV. But I think that with Stranger Things in particular, it works because a large group. In a smaller group, of course, you would have less cuts. And I looked at a smaller group number versus like Stranger Things, how many characters that they have and how many cuts they would need. You'd probably need less than half of what they have. And I think you could do this kind of stuff with what they have. I also like that in this particular scene, you realize that whatever Billy was trying to fight, it's really impervious to defense. There's really no way of fighting it. And you know, you get that thing where you're like, here, bullies are cowards. Billy has never shown himself to be anything other than a true bully, as in he doesn't have the cowardice side. He's a jackass. He'll step up to people. You wouldn't even say he is certainly a bully, but you could just say he's a complete jackass in real life. But you definitely get that moment of fear from him. And I think you also see that moment of fear, but you see just how instantly he loses. Doesn't matter if physically he's sound, if he has a ton of confidence, he loses to the creature almost right away. And he ends up grabbing this girl and, like I said, taking her into the shower. And I thought that was very cool. Now, it cuts to the shopping clothing scenes. They're more carefree in this way. This is Eleven and Max again. And to me, there's a lot of reflections of like Weird Science, Mannequin, those kind of movies where you've got the odd people out sort of getting revenge or having their own fun on their own, sort of making sure that you understand that the protagonists are people too, and that the cool people aren't just the only people. I think we see the opposite of that in Stranger Things. I think they do a very good job of indicating that. But here, they indicate it by having a lot of these moments where the girls are running around shopping. The guys, it's cutting. The guys are also at the mall shopping. And then the girls set up some more popular girls who've teased them once or twice while they were shopping, sets them up by causing one of their milkshakes to explode using Eleven's power while they're talking to some cute boys. I thought this was all done. This was all done pretty well. You get to understand it's less Max pushing, than it is really Eleven just experimenting with being out in a social presence and that giddiness that can happen when you're with your friends when you're young. Well, it can happen when you're an adult too. I have this, but you get a bunch of people together and you have that giddiness that comes up, that energy and that reflection that occurs of energy back and forth between friends. And this was one of the scenes where I didn't so much have a problem with how the girls were portrayed. It actually worked pretty well with Eleven and Max, where in the other moments it didn't as much. Here you do see Eleven mischievous, sort of messing around with people, not necessarily being mean or anything like that, and certainly not doing it first. So it's just really a reaction. But it was very cool. It just solidifies once again that Eleven is a person and is a young teen and is going to have those teen angsty kind of moments. From here, very quickly, it goes over and shows Robin and Steve and Dustin, or at least Robin and Steve, in the ice cream shop. And Robin gives Steve what she's translated. And currently, it makes no sense. It's sort of like most of the old codes you'd see in movies, you know, the long dog walks swiftly across the frozen yard. And you're like, what exactly does that mean? But it fits very well in with the time frame. And it works for you to sort of understand there's some data there in what Robin's telling Steve, but neither one of them know what it is. She certainly doesn't, and he doesn't either. You also realize at this time that Steve was talking to her when he should have been working, because he turns around and there's Eleven and Max getting ice cream. And even Steve knows Eleven should not be out. And he warns her, or basically questions her, and says, "Are you supposed to be out here?" And the girls just laugh and walk off. And I thought it was really cool, because instead of Steve being like, "I guess so," or whatever, he's like, "All right, I didn't." You can tell he didn't understand what the laughing was for. I thought that was cool. The girls walk outside and they randomly bump into Mikey and the boys. They have this argument. And once again, we see Max really antagonistic. And she's basically pushing as hard as she can for Eleven to break up with Mikey, which Eleven ends up doing. And it's very strange, because Max is, she ends up not only calling out the entire group for something that her character wouldn't actually call out anybody for, or even, I guess you would say, really know about, which I thought was really weird and pretty rough writing on the Duffer's part, because what she says doesn't really make any sense. But she says it causes Eleven to react. Eleven walks up to Mikey, who is telling the truth at that point, at least of why they're there. Not telling the truth about what happened, but telling the truth of why they're there. And Eleven says, "I dump your ass." And this is repeated from what Max had told her earlier, which was along the lines of, if he treats you poorly or shitty, you should dump him. And that's what she does. And they end up leaving on a bus that's right outside. I think this entire section, though, does indicate, once again, sort of a difficulty I have, where I get that a lot of these characters want it to be the same. A couple of them don't want it to be the same. But there's been enough already weird experiences with a couple of these that I just hate that moment where you get all the characters together, because that's really what we've done. All the characters together, only to split them up again. This is something I've talked about in games a ton. I hate it. And it happens in games all the time, where you get that strength in numbers, everybody comes together, and then here I wouldn't say it's necessarily not a good excuse for splitting them up, because you do have a breakup, but you get that thing where everybody's together, and then something happens, and they're like, "Okay, we've got everybody together in this cabin in the woods or whatever, let's split up. You guys go to the treehouse 6 miles, you know, farther away," and you get that moment where you're like, "Come on, guys, just think things through just one little bit of time." Here, I think it was fine. Nothing really looked, you know, sort of came across odd here. And it had this really cool Goonies feel, this really cool gamified feel to everybody in the mall and what they were doing. And once again, I think it does a good job of letting you feel the emotion of these side characters as well as the main characters. And the time frame, it did a very good job, once again, of indicating very clearly this is 1980s time frame, and you should sort of pick up on this. I'm not going to spoil this now, because this actually comes up in at the end of this. But one thing I really did like was, while they're actually running around the mall, a couple hints about some things of the story are actually given visually in this mall, and you don't pick up on it. I thought that was very cool. After watching it a second time, you certainly do notice it. So it jumps to City Hall, and Jim is arresting everybody. This is a very short cut. He's simply arresting the last person. He basically says, you know, "You got to go get a permit to do this," puts him in the back of a car. And then, for reasons that don't really make a lot of sense, a person shows up. And I think this was more for money sakes, maybe, or just for sakes of ease. But a person shows up to deliver to him a shirt. This is like Amazon delivery 25 years after or prior to when it really did occur. But this person shows up and delivers to him a shirt, which just didn't make a lot of sense. Gives him a shirt, and you start to see that Jim is, he's actually very excited about his date, or going with Joyce. Not a date per se, because they both made it clear it's not, even though you can get the idea that Hopper thinks it is. But he gets this hilariously loud Hawaiian shirt. It's very cool. And his excitement at that, you realize just how much of a young kid he is at heart, despite his own issues. And I think that's also cool, because you get an idea that, you know, yeah, he's a protector, but he really does like Joyce, and he's trying to figure it out. And this is something that is very well replicated in, I believe it's the last episode, episode one, where he tells Joyce he just wants to make sure she understands that this place is safe for her and her kids to stay. You get an idea of how important it is to him to put them all together. And one thing they did here was they immediately cut to him at that dinner. He's already, it's basically, he gets that shirt and it cuts directly to him waiting for Joyce. He walks in. There's a nice place that he's in. He orders a nice drink and something to eat, I think, and then sits down. But you get this idea of just how important he takes it. He's cleaning himself up. He's sort of primping and preening and making himself look good. What you really get from this moment, though, great scene, is when right at the end of the scene, they show Jim. They show Jim surrounded by a bunch of characters, a bunch of different people who are eating dinner. Number one, he's the only guy alone. And I think we all understand, you know, what sort of what that reflects. But number two, he's so big as a person. This David Arbor is a big person. And you can actually see the way the table is shaped and the way he is. He's so much bigger than the table. He's bigger than everybody there. And I think that's very cool. It gives you this feeling of this character is a massive dude, maybe a little uncomfortable in this situation, but so happy to be in it that regardless of a lack of comfort and regardless of the awkwardness that they obviously quickly display with him here, he is insanely happy to be here regardless of all that. So then it cuts to Joyce and the math teacher going over what's happened. And it hints also about the key, which is very cool. It also hints, there's a couple things. It talks about apophenia, which is seeing patterns that aren't there, here indicating that they're not seeing it, which they actually really are, but giving a scientific reason for why she may be seeing things that seem to make sense, but they're really just coincidence. But the math teacher does explain to her using science to demagnetize these magnets. It would require incredible power requirements for a magnet like that. And I think this is, okay, this is probably the best part of the show, this episode, because he says that, he explains to her to do this, it would cost millions of dollars to make a tool or an item this big to demagnetize magnets, not really discussing the fact that it would demagnetize a good number of things. But they talk about this, and then he says something where he says, once you open up the curiosity door, anything is possible. And I thought that was amazing because it's literally a connection. If you go to the dark side of it, it's a dark side of it. It's more of a connection with the Russians. Opening up that door, anything is going to be possible when they open up, you know, the membrane between here and the upside down. But I don't want to ruin this, but later on there's some discussion. And I'll just say that it's replicated in Max multiple times closing her door on Jim Hopper, closing her door when she has Mikey over and then when Max comes over for a sleepover at a later time. And these moments where that sort of terminology is used that solidifies everything together on multiple levels. It's probably one of the best, I would say, sentences or one of the best lines, sorry, of dialogue given. And we do see this in games. You see this in games a lot of times where somebody gives that key moment and it fits in multiple places. But I would say this is one of those times where due to the way language or the way stories are written and actors are written and how they deliver their lines, they probably have the ability to make it a little bit more concrete in Stranger Things. But man, did it work well. It was that moment when you get it and he said it. And I remember just sitting back going like, yep, I get it. I get exactly why he said that. He said it perfectly because it explained to Joyce what was going on. However, it also explained his life because he's a very curious person and anything is possible. It also explained the Russian side of things. Like if you understand, you know, just how dark of the door they're opening, it also replicates, I guess you could say, quite well with the United States and what they did in the prior seasons. And then also, it's reflected with Jim Hopper and what he says and that continual closing of the door that she does. Very cool. So it cuts to Robin, Steve, and Dustin discussing what appears to be this random sentence. It's about cats, the West, and otherwise. It's like when so-and-so and this thing meet in the West, the cat walks softly, you know, that kind of stuff. Robin really shows just how open she is to everything and understanding of everything at this time. She takes it more as a game. Or not even necessarily a game, but takes it more as a weird situation and not a, oh my God, there's supernatural things. I thought that just worked. And it ended up allowing this character to come in, show her strengths without that slowing down of the story, without her being one more character that pulled it shut. In fact, it's a very good replication or a very good reflection, I'm sorry, of what Robin is going through and that you find out about later, her desire to jump straight into that is very cool as a reflection of what she's actually experiencing in life. Here also, they show that I would say Steve and the fact that he can sort of think on his feet and sort of understand the common elements. He's talking with Robin and Dustin. They're trying to discuss what's going on. Now, behind the sort of the spoken words in this Russian password or this Russian passcode is music. And they walk out of the mall and they pass by one of those rideable horses where you put 25 cents in and it rides. And you see Steve stop and he asks to borrow money and he puts the money into this horse and you see the horse riding and you don't really pick up on what's going on. And then all of a sudden you realize that the music that plays when the horse rides is the same music that was playing during the Russian transmission. And that indicates to them, and they sort of come to the realization that that message was not coming in from Russia, but was actually leaving the mall. And it was being recorded in a place that was near enough to that horse that got into the actual recording and got piped out. And they sort of understand that now there's an issue with the mall. And I think this is that one moment where finally you understand everything's a cornerstone here at the mall. You get the idea that now the mall matters more in many ways. It doesn't only matter because of the economic hardships. It doesn't only matter because of the hardships that it delivers to, or not the hardships, but the issues it delivers for the various characters. You get to see their social dynamic here. But at the same time, now you realize there's something even more sort of dark behind the scenes. It cuts quite quickly to Jim, and he's eating. He's obviously been stood up. He throws an absolute hissy fit, just a drunken fit, takes the alcohol, walks out, says, "I'm the sheriff. I can do whatever I want." And I think it quite quickly shows, once again, something I've talked about. I talked about at the starting of the last episode, that he can fall quite quickly. He is a character that is really on stilts, and the stilts are built of all of these things that he wants to make sure are done. And if somebody kicks him out from under him, he immediately falls. He has just absolutely no balance. As he's leaving, though, strangely enough, he bumps into the Russian at the bar. He bumps into him. He doesn't actually like bump into him, say hi. He bumps into him physically. I found this a little odd because Jim doesn't notice, but additionally, they don't really explain why he's there. You don't really get an idea. Is he following, you know, Jim? Is there a reason why he's there? How did Jim not notice him coming in the door? Because he notices him walking out of the courthouse, but it doesn't really explain that. Lastly, it cuts to Billy. Now, Billy is, at the end of this episode, is taking the lifeguard into the basement, and he finishes off taking her into the basement and sort of sacrificing her to these creatures. And he says something along the lines of, "It'll be over soon," or "It'll be over quickly. Just don't try to move around too much," that kind of thing. And it cuts away with you realizing that he sacrificed her again to this creature. I think this is all really well done. I think episode 2 still might be somewhat weak overall. There's a couple things missing from it, I felt, and it sort of jumped around on, and this is something that we see for episodic games. You'll see this a lot where you have that one episode that feels just a little bit off. I think at times episode 2 certainly does, but it also, strangely enough, has some of the, strangely enough, in a Stranger Things podcast, has some of the greatest one-liners. Certainly the math teacher saying, "Once you open the curiosity door, anything is possible." Absolutely one of the best lines in the show, if you pay attention to what other people say and pay attention thematically. That was awesome. Those are the kind of things that I love to see in games. Those are the kind of moments that I love to see a game director fit into a game, where you sort of get that aha moment. And I got this with Alan Wake many times. There were many times in Alan Wake where something would be said where I was with friends playing it, and I had that aha moment. I think a lot of directors are a little bit nervous about putting those in games because they think either somebody will figure it out early, or maybe even they're worried about this now tech that we're dealing with now, which is like streaming on YouTube and Twitch. Like, are they worried that that kind of stuff will get out in a Let's Play and then everybody will understand the, you know, whatever the spoiler is or something like that? I don't know. I dislike it, though. I dislike that we don't see those kind of things. I think it works really well. I also think those mottos in shows in particular work really well. Let's just talk about mottos for a second. Pet Sematary, "Sometimes dead is better." One of the best one-liners ever delivered in a movie. Really is absolutely amazing, as it sets the place. It gives information in the exact period of time to the character, but it also becomes everything about the show, right? And you have this, you know, once you open the curiosity door, everything is possible. There's a Steven Spielberg TV show about aliens kidnapping people, and Dakota Fanning is a little kid in it. And she says, what choices do you make when all choices hurt? And that stuck with me as a motto. And it certainly is reflected in the TV show from that point on. I like that kind of stuff. We have seen it. In fact, I would say, despite a lot of people's disbelief that the Telltale series are actually games, we've seen that a lot of people argue that, where they're like, oh, you're just hitting A or whatever. I get that. But there's parts in those shows where I think a character says something that later on, when they do a, like, last time on this Telltale's game, they'll keep continue to cut back to it because it's poignant, right? It matters. And it's really the theme of the story. And we see that. I would like to see it a little bit more because I don't think we have it too much. I think it's a cool thing when you have a motto. I think there's something very strong about it. There's something very strong, for example, about saying last time on, right? On a TV, last time on the TV show Lost, because that used to do it. Last time on this show, last time on this. And just last time indicates what you're going to see from this point on, at least for a moment, is going to be this sort of the summary of the combined actions of whatever occurred prior. And that works for that show. Sometimes Dead is Better works for that show because it's about a pet cemetery where people are buried there and they start to come alive, but they are better off dead because they come alive demonic, right? It fits in all these places. Halo, you could say Halo's got a couple of them. I would certainly say for a lot of people, when he says, wake me if you need me or whatever, is a big motto for that game. And something you'll see game players talk about. Witcher probably has one. I'm going to be honest, I don't remember it, but I wouldn't doubt if Witcher has one. And Witcher probably has a couple when it comes visually. I know the unicorn sex toy certainly would fit that bill. But I'd like to know what you guys think. If you get a chance, tweet at me, say, if whether you agree or disagree, if you like these, maybe state, something. Hopefully I pointed out something you hadn't noticed in the show. Maybe you can point out something I didn't notice. It certainly does happen. I would love to hear it. If you get a chance, make sure to tweet this out, man. I would absolutely love it if you tweeted this out to people. I would love to talk more about games, more about the setups, the stories. This episode sort of turned into a good discussion, I think, about dialogue and theme and where you put your, where you sort of put your meat and where it's going to matter, the meat to your stew of a story. And I think that's very cool. It's a little different than the other episode. So there was a lot here in this episode, not my favorite, but very cool to discuss these kind of things. Also, if you would like me to break something down more about games, I certainly can do that, because this is just me sort of like noticing something in a game that overlaps, for example, the rungs of a ladder and how those all come together. So again, share it on Twitter, share it on Facebook, share it wherever you can. It absolutely helps. Tell people to subscribe. That is it for me. Oh, last, sorry. You can certainly join me on Patreon. I got to say, it's a godsend, because YouTube really is a disaster right now. And Patreon, listening here, telling other people about it does help. It's a huge deal. There, I can't stress that enough. Showing that support in that way really does help. So if I've saved you any money on a game, or maybe found a game you weren't expecting, or maybe gave you a little entertainment here, maybe come to the Patreon and check it out. That's it for me. Peace out, and enjoy the rest of your week.